Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The FBI file on today's guest says, quote, he is extremely eloquent, therefore extremely dangerous. From 1969 to 1979, the FBI collected a 17,000-page file on John Trudell, an acclaimed poet, recording artist, and indigenous rights activist. He's well known for becoming one of the main voices of the occupation of Alcatraz in November 1969. In October 1972, he took part in the American Indian Movement's Trail of Broken Treaties Caravan March on the Bureau of Indian Affairs in D.C. From November 3rd to the 7th, they occupied the Department of the Interior. The Nixon administration rejected their demands to revive Native sovereignty, but instead authorized $66,000 for gas money to send the caravan back where it came from. John Trudell continued his work with AIM, serving as chair from 73 to 79, and so much happened during that time. In February of 79, a fire of unknown origin killed Trudell's wife, three children, and mother-in-law. It was through this horrific tragedy that he began to find his voice as an artist and poet, writing in his words to stay connected to this reality. John Trudell has also been a leading voice for the legalization of hemp through the project Hempstead Project Heart. Hempstead was created by the Olders, Willie Nelson and John Trudell, to promote a conscious recognition of the qualities of industrial hemp as a renewable economic alternative green energy resource. He says hemp is one of the most important issues of our time. As part of the fourth annual Hemp History Week, the documentary film Bringing It Home, which tells the story of hemp's past, present, and future, will be screened in San Francisco tonight at 7 p.m., Intermission, San Francisco, 2050 Bryant Street. And John Trudell will be at tonight's screening, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, John.
Hello.
Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, it's nice to be seen.
Well, I was doing so much reading about you over the last couple of days, and I've never heard you talk about the fact that you majored in radio and television in college.
Well, it doesn't come up much. but yeah, that was my major. Radio and television,
yeah.
Programming and production. When I got out of the Navy.
Because you served 2 years in Vietnam, right?
I did two tours of Vietnam. I was in the Navy for 3 years and 10 months. And then out of that, I did two Westpac tours. There were six, 7 months, something like that. And then when I got out, yeah, my major, I went to San Bernardino Valley College. Because at that time, I wanted to stay in California, and for radio and television, San Francisco State and San Bernardino had the two best programs in California. So I went to the junior college one because it was just an easier gig and deal to get into. So I spent a year and a half there before I dropped out and went to Alcatraz. So so with the radio, well, radio and TV, so I wrote PSAs, I did speech 1A, did all the, learn all the history of the stuff. And so, you know, I did at the college, so I had my own radio. I did a couple of different radio shows. One was a country music show, and one was some kind of a talk magazine show with three or four of us did that kind of stuff. And I wrote, and at some point I wrote all the PSAs. It eventually came to the point where and PSAs basically, that's how you're learning how to write commercials, but in college, they call them PSAs, right?
Right.
So all that kind of stuff. And then I did the same thing with TV. So I did, you know, on air, in front of the cameras, behind the cameras, the boom, all the stuff.
And that gave you a lot of training for what you did with the occupation of Alcatraz.
Well, because, I mean, I really had no coherent reason for taking that as my major anyway. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I just said, well, okay, I'll do that. And, but yeah, ironically, so that I went through school from January or February of 68 till the fall of 69, so a little over a year, three semesters maybe, or whatever you call them.
Yeah.
And then I left school. I had a disagreement, so within my major. And so I pretty much just turned off to it.
What was the disagreement?
A student job. There was a student job up for grabs, and I needed the money, and I needed the job, and I was in my own opinion, I was the best qualified to do it, right? In my own opinion. But so we'll put that in there. But the deal is somebody else got the job because two department heads were showing who has the most authority. So that's why I didn't get the job, is because one department head wanted to show he was the big dog to the other department head. You know, and when I called them on it, I asked them, well, why, you know, so in the end, they just told me, well, that's the way it is in the business, and you have to learn to accept it. And I just said, no, I don't.
Hmm. So it's interesting because you started in radio and television. What are your thoughts today about the power of the media?
I think the power of the media doesn't diminish. I don't think it ever has. I think that it's at whatever technological advancement, state of advancement the media is, they use it to their maximum effectiveness to psychologically manipulate people's perceptions of reality. I don't think that's ever changed. That's what the purpose of it is for. So I don't think they're more powerful than they were before when you place it into context. When it was just radio come out and they could hear it, well, they did to the best of their effects with that, and now we've got instant holograms and stuff. See, but to me, the system works as effectively. The primitiveness of the technology, all right, it works as effectively as possible with whatever the technology is at any given time. So I think that, I think that basically the reality of it is there's an industrial ruling class on this planet. And people talk about communism, capitalism, all the different things. But in reality, there's an industrial ruling class on this planet. And they own the capitalists. They own the communists. They own the socialists. And they own the religions. They create these things, right? Because I think there's a great deal of that kind of thing that goes on. And so in that context, the media is just like religion or like nationalism or politics, right? It's there to manipulate, to manipulate the mass. You know, I would suggest there's this BBC documentary called Century of Self. And I would recommend that people watch that documentary because basically what they're talking about is it's a very clear-cut explanation of how the manipulation of the mass psychology was very deliberately created at the turn of the century, the 1900s, and how they used Freud's nephew to do it. Because at the turn of the century, the 1900s, most Americans, at that time, America was now hitting the mass production line, where they could do stuff in mass. So the industrial age had hit that. But see, Americans were still living from the last century, so they were only buying what they needed. Not what they wanted, what they needed. They were still frugal in that kind of way. So they brought Freud's nephew over here, all right, to devise a plan, all right, to get people to buy more than they needed, all right, now to go into the realms of want, psychological manipulation on a mass scale. You know, so yeah, and the media was.
Well, and what's interesting is, you know, I follow you on Facebook, and you really embrace social media.
Well, I mean, it's interesting about. I do and I don't, because I don't. What I know how to do on Facebook is post.
You post a lot.
I know how to post notes, but that's basically what I do.
Yeah.
I post notes, right? That I write myself, and once in a while, an article here or there.
Yeah.
Right. And I do it for something to do.
Well, it affects people because sometimes you post poetry that you write, or sometimes you post articles about hemp
yeah, right.
legalization.
Yeah.
And I mean, you get a lot of people follow you, and there a dialogue actually happens.
Well, it's a poor dialogue because I don't dialogue back.
Sometimes but, you do, but you. Yeah,
but generally, I don't. But yeah, no, it's there, and you know, but really, my whole experience with the Facebook thing, because number one, I mean, because in reality, I'm really pre-literate with this technology. I mean, I know how to send an email. I know how to do certain basic things on a computer, but if it goes beyond basic. Same thing with Facebook. I know how to do certain basic things. And I went into Facebook because, I wanted to see what it was all about. And it's a good, and for me, it was a good way. I do my writing, so I just post it there, and I have it there, right? But that's really, you know, what it is, because I don't really interact that much on the Facebook thing, but it gives me a good idea to see how people respond and to certain things.
Right, and see what people are thinking about,
yeah.
Right? You know, it's interesting, too, because a lot of people have learned about hemp through your Facebook page, and through everything that you've been through, why did you decide to embrace this cause?
Well, I don't have a real clear-cut, concise answer to why I decided, but I did. But when it comes down to, when I look at everything that's going on right now in the world, so to speak, but let's deal specifically with this country, in America. Number one, I think that hemp is healthy for the planet. Well, I know that it is, because you don't need chemicals to grow it. You don't need the pesticides. You don't need the poison for it to grow. And when we look at what's going on, you know, because in a large way, I think the activist communities are in a quandary. They're not really, they don't have any solutions to the problems that are going on, you know. Don't have any solutions. Don't really know what to do, the activist community, other than to just go out and protest the way that we've been doing it for years and years. But the same old behavior patterns going on and on and on, but no solution. And the same old behavior patterns been going on and on all my life, right? And yet the problem is worse than it was when we started out. So something not happening here that just doesn't, something just not synchronizing. And it's all right now. So when I look at it, well, the environmental situation, and what I mean by environment, I mean global warming, I mean poisoning the water, right? I mean economics, not enough jobs. I mean just the whole thing. So when I look at all these problems going on, and then I look at hemp, see, and I think hemp could address a great many of those issues, right? It can address us. Like I question in my mind why environmentalists aren't out there pushing for hemp. I really do. I mean, you know, it's like it because hemp would literally make fresh oxygen for the sky that's being suffocated with carbon dioxide. So I think that's an effective, it would help to deal with global warming. You can make fuel out of it, which helps to deal with the global warming, getting away from the carbons. All right? You can make clothing out of it. You can make shelter. You can make hempcrete. You can make shelter. You can make a vehicle out of it. You can, it had the medicinal, and I'm not just talking about the medical marijuana. I'm talking about the medicinal aspects of hemp, from the oils and the things that don't get you high, right? You know, and the foodstuffs, the clothing, it makes a better quality of paper. See, so hemp serves every need. And, you know, and I heard, especially I remember hearing it when Obama was running first time, and all this terminology being tossed out there about a green economy. You know, and a lot of people I hear that talked about green economy and wanting alternative energy, especially environmentalists, because I got a little bone to pick with environmentalists to some degree on this, right? But they're ignoring hemp. Mm. They're not even thinking about hemp. You know, and yet my bone to pick is not that I think there's something wrong with them, but I understand that people don't know about hemp because they've been deliberately they've deliberately had the information withheld from them. But really, in reality, if we're looking for solutions to protecting the environment, then to me, it's up to it's environmentalists. They have a responsibility to check all the possibilities. But people fall into this niche. They're for wind energy, or they're for solar energy, or they're for water energy. See, and they stay in that niche, and they don't expand beyond it.
You also question people who push for the legalization of medical marijuana, who are not who don't talk about hemp.
Yeah, because. To me, we get into fine lines here, all right? Because I understand and appreciate the medicinal values of marijuana, all right? But, you know, but sometimes I think about it because most pot smokers, whether it's recreational marijuana, see, they have this thing that they're in on something that, know what I mean? That they have the answer to what's going on, and the pot's the thing, and this and that, right? And I mean, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's kind of, well, hold it, we figured something out, right? But yet at the same time, when I see them talking about medicinal marijuana for people, and not looking, considering the earth. Well, see, the earth needs medicine too. And hemp is earth medicine. It is. See, so what I kind of look at that, well, hold on here. How enlightened are we really? Because, well, we want the medicine for us, but we don't want it for the mother. See, which kind of tells me, all right, see, it says, so this got to do with levels of consciousness, you know, and which makes me, and the medical marijuana, I understand that it is beneficial and helpful, and the recreational marijuana, it's beneficial and helpful. And I understand all that, and I don't have a quarrel with that. But I do think that the medical marijuana people, you know, if they want to talk about medicine, if then I think they should be inclusive to the hemp. You know, because I remember just hearing it, green economy. Well, this is it. This is what it is. What people have been talking about, saying that they want hemp can help to address that. And see, and I think that. I would like to see more of environmentalists, including hemp, whatever their environmental specialty is. I would like to see them including hemp, because it's what we all have in common. And if we want to get down to practical realities, right, hemp is the one, it maybe, if you really look at it, it's the one which I find interesting. It's not as big of a polarization issue, because when you look at the right and the left, and there's like 19 states that have passed hemp legislation approving it for the state. They can't do anything with it because it's against federal law, but 19 states. But you know, in almost every one of those states, it's Republicans, conservatives, all right, that are advocating for it. So the right and the left, all right, the extremes of the right and the left are in agreement about this.
The Colorado governor just signed an industrial hemp bill into law.
Yeah. No, it's all right. See, and so there's a lot of room there with this for the hemp thing, and I think that it should be explored. Otherwise, to me, you know, it's I look at the anti-fracking people. Well, they need to get a grip on this. The fracking's going to happen if they don't come up with something original to stop it. If they don't come up, see. And I think the anti-fracking people should be talking about hemp. It'll create economies in North Dakota. It would create economies in these places, all right, where the water, that would be completely, it would create economies.
Well, you know, and we have a lot of environmentalists who listen to the show, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because we're talking today with John Trudell, who says that hemp needs to be near the top of our lists, and he is critical of the environmental movement because it hasn't really embraced hemp, doesn't really talk about it. And John, also, we're going to talk with him about, well, you said earlier that the activist community is in a quandary. And not really focusing on solutions. So we'll also talk about that. And then I'm sure many of you are familiar with John and his work with the American Indian Movement. I mean, so much has happened during John's life, and he will be speaking tonight at the airing of Bringing It Home, which tells the story of hemp's past, present, and future, 2050 Bryant in San Francisco. And then John and his band Bad Dog will be doing two special concerts to celebrate Hemp History Week tomorrow night at the Brower Center in Berkeley.
On Saturday night.
And then on, oh, that's Saturday night.
Yeah.
And then
Sunday
in Petaluma at the Sunflower Center. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org.
And I'm not being critical of the environment. I'm being observational.
Thank you. Hey, I have to use that word more often instead of critical. Observational. And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a question for John or a comment about his observations, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, you know, we'll talk more about hemp throughout the show, but what are your observations? I often wonder what you think of when you look at what we're facing today and what you dealt with in the late 60s, early 70s, when, you know, the FBI was collecting a 17,000-page file on you.
Well, I just hearing on the news how they're subpoenaed all of the Verizon phone users, their stuff. See, so now how do I feel about it? Well, welcome to the club, right? I feel like a pioneer. They're doing it to everybody now. That's what I notice. All right, if we want to get right down to it. All right, and the thing that the difference that then and now, so to speak, just in what's movement wise, just what's going on. I think that nothing has really changed between then and now. Cosmetics on the surface, technology, terminology change, but when you get right down to the ruling behavior systems and patterns, they haven't really changed. The technology is now more advanced, right? And so they have more control over us. But but when I look at it, so we started out in the 60s, and our motives and our intentions were good. We were idealistic, you know, and we were the majority, young, you know, and all of that. And so we wanted a different world. So we threw everything we had into it, trying to get that happen. And we did raise consciousness about sexism, war, environment, minority, all the terminology, but we did raise consciousness and stuff. But when you get right down to it in the long run, we didn't really change anything. On the surface, we did. All right, there are more black students in college now, more native students in college now, right? But there are also more poor natives and more poor blacks that don't have access to college. See, so, you know, so I mean, when you get right down to, all right, women, they've made great advances in women's rights, but yet at the same time, women are still having to... It's a constant struggle, right? There's still no equal parity in pay and things like, certain, you know. So what has really changed? The thing that I see that has really changed is that the authoritarian state is more entrenched now than it was when we started out. And so the difference between then and now is, well, now the generation now that's got to deal with the problems that are in front of us, right? I don't know if my generation left them enough information how to do it without repeating the mistakes of the past. You know, and I think that because what we did in my generation, and we bought some time. We didn't change anything. We just bought some time, all right, because the state is more entrenched than it was when we started, all right? So we didn't really change anything. We bought some time. So when I look back at that, but our intentions were good, our motives were good, our idealism, so where did we not go right? And I think that we didn't go right because we didn't think our way through it. We emotionally reacted, all right? We used our intelligence to emotionally react rather than using our intelligence to think with clarity and coherency. See, so we emotionally reacted and tried to break, we emotionally react and tried to create change using the same perception of reality that our oppressor was using. We didn't change our perception of reality.
We're going to take a quick break. We're talking today with John Trudell, longtime Indigenous rights activist. The FBI collected a 17,000-page file on him, calling him extremely eloquent. They gave you a nice compliment and said, therefore, extremely dangerous. John does a lot of work today. He is a spoken word artist. He's got a band, Bad Dog, and he's also working to legalize hemp. We'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have for John Trudell? We'll be back after this.
There are many ways to take part in the conversation on your call, on the phone, via email, or on our website, yourcallradio.org. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK.
Rich man's war. Industrial streets. Class lines, money talks. Turning language to paper pieces. Rich man's war. Free man society. Raging, violent insecurity. Nuclear man, nuclear woman, unclear how to act. Rich man's war. Pershing's cruising Europe. America, Russia. Governmental nuclear views. Industrial allies cutting the world as though they cannot see blood flowing.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss media coverage of the trial of Bradley Manning, the Army soldier who was arrested for allegedly passing classified material to WikiLeaks. We'll also talk about the Associated Press phone hacking scandal and the ongoing protests in Turkey. We've got a lot to talk about tomorrow. And if you saw a story that you want to bring to our attention, we'd love to check it out. You can email it to your feedback at yourcallradio.org. And also email us if you have a show idea or a guest idea. Today, we are joined by John Trudell, who is best known for his Indigenous rights activism. He worked with the American Indian Movement, serving as chair from 1973 to 79. After majoring in radio and television in college, he was one of the main voices of the occupation of Alcatraz in November 69. He's been a leading voice for the legalization of hemp. He also does a lot of spoken word, and he's got a band, Bad Dog. They're going to be performing Saturday at the Brower Center in Berkeley and Sunday at the Sunflower Center in Petaluma. It's a great space. So if you have some time, you should check that out. And then tonight, as part of the fourth annual Hemp History Week, the documentary film Bringing It Home, which tells the story of hemp's past, present, and future, will be screened at 2050 Bryant Street in San Francisco. And John will be there on a panel tonight. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you have a question for John about the work he's done with AIM, what his thoughts are when he looks back, and how he thinks, you know, what he thinks we're dealing with today, what are the best ways to respond to that, why he got involved in hemp, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And let's hear from Joseph in San Francisco. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Brother John, it is what it is. It's a pleasure to hear you, man, and I go back a long way following in your shadow. My question for you is, what is currently going on with AIM, and what's happened with Brother Ward Churchill? I'll take my hands off here. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, I really don't know anymore what's going on with AIM. I mean, see, to me, in my world, my perception of it, there's two AIMs. There's the AIM of the 70s, the days that when I was young and we were all a part of that. And then there's the AIM that exists now, but I'm not active in that AIM. I know that AIM has chapters active in different parts of the country, but I'm not active in it anymore. But I know that AIM is still functioning in different areas.
Why aren't you active in it anymore?
Well, let me ask you. And as far as Ward Churchill, you know, I don't have a clue what's going on with Ward Churchill. You know, I was never a part of his reality, so I really don't know what the deal is with Ward. I never really did know, and I still don't really know. All right, so I mean that. You know, I'm not trying to say good or bad. I'm just stating, you know, what it is about that. Now, what was that you said?
Why aren't you part of AIM anymore?
Well, part of it had to do with the fire, but I knew the AIM days were coming. They were winding down. I knew this even before the fire. I just knew that this has gone as long as it can. I made the decision that I didn't want to be. I didn't want a political identity anymore. I don't see political activists solving the problem, right? It was like, because when I looked at it and I was thinking, well, when I was AIM political activist, I was viewing, that was my identity. I was viewing the world. I identified as a political activist. That's how I viewed the world. But, you know, when I really think about it, well, that's a very limited view of the world, because as a political activist, that's how I'm going to see the world. I'd rather see the world as a human being, right? Then I can see the world more succinctly and more clearly. But when you go as a political activist, then you got your bias and your prejudice. So it's about having more of an open objectivity with part of it. Politics. I don't trust politics. I don't trust anybody's politics. I don't care whose they are. I don't trust politics because politics are competitive. There's no other way around it. They're competitive. They are not collective and cooperative. They may pretend to be at times, but really the nature of politics is competitive. Nature of politics is territorial, and the nature of politics is egotistical. They develop egos, all of these things. See, so to me, that's a lot of confusion. That's a lot of energy I just didn't need to deal with. It creates all this chaos. So that was a part of why I left.
Hmm.
And I don't think, and when I really look at it in practical terms, you know, and I don't mean any disrespect to anybody, but in practical terms about facing reality, the political activists haven't solved anything. And we haven't. And I'll put me in, you know, but what have we solved? I mean, really think about it. You know, all we can do is we just go out and vent more frustrations at what's going on, you know, and so that's part. This so that's also a part of it because it's got to do with what I said earlier. The reason we didn't pull us off in the '60s, we were the majority in our youth, was because we didn't think our way through. We emotionally reacted. We didn't think outside. We didn't think outside the perceptual reality we had been imprinted to believe in. We didn't think outside. See, and that's what I see, and that's what I think is the missing part now, is to think with clarity, to have enough respect for our intelligence, to have enough respect for our intelligence to think clearly and coherently, to have enough respect for our intelligence to like ourselves, to have enough respect for the Creator and all the spiritual holy holies we say that we're after, to respect our intelligence. See, and how do we do that? We use it to think. We use it to think, but it needs to be done with clarity and coherency. Because we're inside of a system. We're in everything in this dimensional reality is about energy. Everything is about energy. Everything that's ever going to happen here is about energy. It's an energetic reality. And living in this reality, so this industrial ruling class, Western civilizations, the industrial ruling class that basically controls this planet, all right, they mine us by how they imprint us to perceive reality, you know, and how we're imprinted to perceive reality through believing rather than thinking. We're not encouraged to think. We're actually imprinted to believe.
Well, and then so when you talk about your activism, you took that activism and turned it into art through your spoken word. And that's another way to bring out these ideas. And you've been really very effective at it.
Well, it's just, to me, it's about communicating. That's what I want. I want to be able to communicate some coherency. But back to this thing, see, so about the energy thing. So it's a system designed to consume energy. So for us, what we need to do is we need to put some thinking into what we need to put some thinking into what we're doing. How do we prevent it from consuming our energy? How do we deal with a system? All right, so that it doesn't consume our energy, all right? Because if you go protest, with or without permission, with or without the permits, all right, it's the system designed to consume that energy, all right? And it is. The police get to come out, and they get to do war games, and we buy magic markers and plastic bottles of water, and so everything, see, so it's all designed in such a way they can absorb that energy. So we need to be thinking in terms of how do we not cooperate? See, because we got imprinted into our minds civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience, or anarchy civil disobedience. But civil disobedience, we got imprinted into our mind. That was the way. But it's not the way. The way is non-cooperation. See, because we've been having, there have been civil disobedience has been going on since there have been oppressors, and still there's a need for it. So it's about non-cooperation. How do we not cooperate with them? How do we not feed them our energy? And there are many degrees of this. How do we not feed them our energy? Like one of the degrees is, you know, how do we not cooperate with them? Well, how about liking ourselves? That's an act of non-cooperation. How many people truly, truly like themselves? I mean, seriously, how many people really, really like themselves? I mean, in the sense that they don't feel overwhelmed by their insecurities and their fears and am I good enough stuff? You know, how many people, and everybody that plays that game is cooperating. All right, is cooperating. All right, they're feeding their energy. All right, so that's on an individual basis. All right, and on a collective basis, you know, like using this Occupy thing as an example. You know, and this one here, I mean, because people were, that's a primary example of an emotional reaction to something rather than a well thought out, well planned, coherent objective. The Occupy movement was an emotional reaction to the Arab Spring and all, and George Bush, all the stuff that was going on was an emotional reaction to it, right? But it didn't accomplish anything. Everybody got to feel good for a little while, and the police in some cities, the police got to come and beat people up, and right? But and I don't mean any disrespect, but I mean when you just look at what the actual result of it is, this is an actual result. Now, so anyway, but in a way, Occupy, that whole movement, not just them, but that whole idea was based upon cooperating with the system through protest. Now let's just think. Now, if all of the money, time, money, resources, all of the energy that had been put into the Occupy movement had been put into organizing people not to spend any money on the same day. You know, if their objective, let's say, let's try to get a third of the population not to spend any money on this date. See, that would have had an impact, and it would have.
We're speaking with John Trudell, longtime Indigenous rights activist, and he's now dedicating, well, most of his time to raising awareness about hemp and the legalization of hemp. He says that this needs to be one of the top issues of our time. And if you'd like to speak with John, if you have a question or comment for John, if you were involved in AIM back then, what are your thoughts on what he's saying about political movements and the activist community being in a quandary right now? We talk about solutions on the show, John, on a regular basis. So what are your thoughts on what John is saying about how to bring in those concrete solutions? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're getting a lot of emails, actually, about hemp, and we'll get to those in just a minute. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Rich in Ben Lomond. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Good morning. You know, I've got a couple of solutions. Speaking of Native Americans, I met some Apaches back in the early 70s, and I did what's known as a peyote ceremony. Now, you talk about Mother Earth and everything, it really gives you a connection. I would suggest that this is a way of enlightenment. And also, one of the things of the society is we eat a lot of sugar, and if you talk to your Native, well, not Native, but Eastern medicines, they talk about yin versus yang. See, if you overload your body with too much sugar, you become in an unhealthy state. And so these are my recommendations. Try peyote and don't eat sugar, and I think we might get somewhere.
That makes sense to me.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. We've got a couple of questions about the events. Tonight, the film Bringing It Home starts at 7 o'clock at Intermission SF, 2050 Bryant Street. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And then John and his band Bad Dog will be playing Saturday night at the Brower Center in Berkeley. And that is... what time does that one start, John?
I think it's a 7:30 showtime.
Okay. And then on Sunday night in Petaluma at the Sunflower Center.
At 7:30 also.
7:30. Okay, 7:30. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And then we've got a couple other emails. One listener wanted you to comment about what's happening in Indian country. And Bella says, what do you think are the most pressing issues in Indian country, especially in the plains where you're from? Suicide, alcoholism, unemployment, and wrenching poverty are the headlines we usually see when we see headlines at all. What doesn't the broader culture know about what's going on among tribes that is important?
Well, the law. There's five types of law recognized by this country: common law, criminal law, constitutional law, statute law, and treaty law. What people need to really understand, the most dominant issue is the violation and breaking of those laws. Because, you know, most Americans look at it and say, oh, well, it's a shame we broke the treaties, and like it's a moral or an ethical. I mean, it is those things, but like they just leave it as though it's a moral or an ethical issue. But that's not. But it's not just that. It's a legal issue. Treaties are laws. So how is America? America cannot break close to 400 treaty laws with the various tribes and still be a nation of laws. And what people need to get a grasp of, right? People need to, so whatever's going on here, this by fact, this isn't a nation of laws, because you can't break these laws and still be a nation of laws. So the American citizens need to start thinking in terms of the laws and the breaking of the laws, because now their constitutional laws are being broken, being violated. See, so they're the new Indians. They're coming into this because, see, because the poverty, the alcoholism, the suicide rates, all of the unemployment, all of these things that are going on. See, it's got, but they're all results of the United States government not obeying the law. See, so all these other little things are categories that go under that, the law, because obey the law.
Bella also wants to know, if you don't trust politics and you're disenchanted with activism, how do you believe we as individuals in society can make change?
Take responsibility. Show respect to ourselves and our intelligence. Take responsibility. All right. Take responsibility for our actions. All right. And that's pretty much what it is. It's about us taking responsibility. Because, you know, I don't trust the politics, but who does? I mean, really. I mean, if you really, really think about it, who does? Who truly, truly trusts politics? All right. We may join some political group and we trust that while we're in it. Right. But I mean, overall, everybody knows, it, like used car salesmen. Everybody knows. Right. See, you know, so there's something fishy going on here. And I don't think that I'm disillusioned with these things. These are my observational. If I was disillusioned, I think it would be. I don't feel like I'm disillusioned, but I feel like this is what I'm seeing going on around me. Because, see, we all want to pat ourselves on the back because we're righteous in our cause and in our movement. And we put our stuff out there. So we want to pat ourselves on the back for the stuff. All right. But we're not really open to hearing. We're not really open to hearing what I would say neutral observations about the results of our activities. We only want to hear, we want only the pat on the backs. But practical reality is, and we owe it to this next generation, we owe it to our individual selves to be realistic and tell ourselves the truth about what's going on and face the mistakes and understand the mistakes were mistakes and learn from them, right? Because right now it's like you know, because the solutions, whether it's on our individual lives or whether it's our collective or generational, societal or generational life. See, we've been looking for political solutions or economic solutions. See, but really we haven't really approached it from the point of energy. How do we work with our energy? The solutions are in how we work with our energy individually and then collectively. But how we work with our energy, how we apply our energy. Do we apply our energy because we're emotionally blowing off something, or do we apply our energy with a very specific tactical direction?
We're speaking with John Trudell, a longtime Indigenous rights activist who is now working on legalizing hemp with Willie Nelson with the group Hempstead Project Heart. And John, as you can see, we've got full lines.
So I talk long enough, I'll
get going. The energy is out there. So why don't we take a couple calls in a row, and then we'll get a response from John. Let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'll turn this down.
Thank you.
I just want to suggest that hemp makes such wonderful fabric that maybe if you suggested that to women who are now taking up sewing in tremendous numbers, apparently, that hemp is such a beautiful thing to work with. And I've had a large tote bag that looks like linen and is the strongest tote bag I've ever had. So I just want to be sure that you mention that sometime, and maybe some more women would come aboard.
Ah, well, you know, I love my hemp clothes, and it's a great point. Thank you. Just a quick fact. In 1619, because hemp was such an important resource, it was illegal not to grow it. In Jamestown, Virginia, Massachusetts, and Connecticut had similar laws. So thank you for that. We'll get a quick history of why this happened and why it became illegal in just a couple minutes. Thank you, Nancy. Let's hear from Junie in Turtle Island. Hi, Junie. Welcome to the show.
If you'd like to make a...
Sorry, we lost you, Junie. Let's go to Mike in Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning. Hi, John.
Hello, man.
Hey, you going to make it down to Santa Cruz?
Well, at some point. At some point, yeah.
Okay. Hey, I was listening in, and I heard you mention about supposed to be a nation of laws and really breaking, you know, breaking many laws repeatedly over. And then this new world order, climate, and once even the pretense of sticking to the Constitution is really done away with, you've got a world constitution. So, I mean, even keeping in mind all the violations that have taken place, you know, against the people, Native Americans included. How do you see, just foundationally wise, where the Constitution even, how pertinent, the foundation of that is? And if that's set aside, then what's left is really a world constitution.
Well, can you hold that thought, John? Because I just want to take a few more callers before we end.
I'll try. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
About Constitution.
I'll remember it. Thank you. Let's hear from Denise in Vallejo. Hi, Denise.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love everything that you're saying, Mr. Trudell, about the movement and how we should approach the movement and how we should be involved individually. And I'm so supportive of the hemp movement as well. I'm curious about if you have any opinion on bamboo in addition to hemp, not to exclude hemp, but if you have any opinion on bamboo as a fiber and a fabric, and I'd like to take my answer off the air.
Yeah, well, no, I think all growable crops, because bamboo is a good energy and it's a good, and it has very many resources, and there's, switchgrass. There's these different. I mean, we could literally make a great deal of our fuel. We could grow our fuel to a large degree, all right, and our shelters and all of these things. So I think bamboo. I think anything. I think it's all. It all should be on the table, and it all should be explored and looked at.
And it is so fascinating when you look at the history that in 1619 it was illegal not to grow hemp.
The first grow law in this country was they had to grow hemp. And to the Constitution thing, what I want to say about the Constitution, it's all been a scam from the beginning, all right? The Constitution, the democracy, all of it's been a scam, because if you look at it, the Constitution, when the Constitution was ratified and approved and all this and that, the people that drew it up, it was created to protect the white male landowner. And it has not changed one iota from that time. Because when they read this Constitution, the only people that could vote for it were white land-owning males. If you were a female, you couldn't vote. If you were a white male that didn't own land, you couldn't vote. If you were an Indian, you couldn't vote. If you were black, you couldn't vote. All right, see, so to understand, all the rest of it just kind of sleight of mind and mumbo-jumbo about what it all represents. But they're staying pretty consistent with their Constitution, in the sense of when you break it down to the bare bones, all right, because their backup system is the Electoral College. Oh, no, and now their new backup system is they program all the computers that count the votes. So it's all a big scam.
We have a couple other questions just about hemp, and can you talk a little bit more about the history of hemp and why did it become illegal?
Well, hemp, up until the 1880s, it was the largest cultivated crop on this planet. And hemp, with hemp, the versatility of the plant, you can make anything out of it, and the evolution of Western civilization is very intertwined with hemp. That's what they made the ropes to make the rigging, to make the sails. They made the sails out of it to put on the ships, right? They fed, sheltered, all of this. So it's always been an integral part.
And on the website, the Hempstead Project Heart, President Thomas Jefferson said, quote, "Hemp is of first necessity to the wealth and protection of the country." President George Washington said, make the most you can of the Indian hemp seed and sow it everywhere.
See, and so hemp was a very integral part. The War of 1812 between Britain and the U.S. was about hemp. Because the British were interfering with they were blockading the Spanish hemp from coming to. All right, see, so anyway, it has all that. And it was used, had the versatility. And then in the mid-1800s, they discovered oil. And then over the next 50 years up into the 1900s, they developed the machinery and the mechanisms and figured out how to exactly use this industrial revolutionary thing with the oil. But basically, hemp will do the same thing oil will do. And then so you get into this is where the marijuana issue comes in. See, so by 1937, the Interior Department and the Department of Agriculture, all the government agencies had realized that hemp, they projected hemp to be the next billion-dollar crop for agriculture and industry. And simultaneously to that, they waged a war. They started waging this war on marijuana. All right, so what the real deal is, it's always been about the hemp. It's never been about the pot. They created pot, all right, because everybody knew hemp. It was a part of the American fabric. It was just part of the American lifestyle. It was there and it was there.
Well, those quotes
right.
Really
and then,
show
so,
that.
By the early 1900s, they realized that hemp could do everything that oil could do. Hemp could do what trees could do. It could make better paper. It could make better lumber, all right? Hemp could do, and then, you know, and because out of the petrochemical thing, this is where the chemicals came from. So then all of a sudden they could make plastics, they could do all the stuff.
John, we have just 20 seconds left. So do you think this is actually, these laws will be passed at the state level? Is that the approach you're all taking here?
Well, what our approach is to just raise awareness about it and get people thinking about it, and then they go how they want to go.
And again, tonight, if you want to learn more about this, you can see the new film, Bringing It Home, which talks about hemp's past, present, and future, 7 o'clock, 2050 Bryant Street in San Francisco. John and his band, Bad Dog, will perform Saturday, 7:30, Brower Center in Berkeley, Sunday, 7:30 in Petaluma at the Sunflower Center. Find more information, yourcallradio.org. John Trudell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the trial of Bradley Manning, the Army soldier who was arrested for allegedly passing classified material to WikiLeaks. We'll also talk about the Associated Press phone hacking scandal and the ongoing protests in Turkey. We'll be joined by Fire Dog Lake's Kevin Gostola, McClatchy's Michael Doyle, and freelance journalist Justin Vella. What did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Work with Marty Nemko. I'll debunk 8 so-called career truths that I don't think are so true. Plus, you can call in for a 3-minute workover. I'll do my best to cure your career conundrum on Work with Marty Nemko, Sunday at 11. That's Sundays from 11 to noon here on 91.7, your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
Up next here on local public radio, our weekly broadcast of Bina. Following that at open air, following that at 1 o'clock, it's open air here on KALW San Francisco, online at KALW.org. Time's 11 o'clock. BBC's World Have Your Say is next.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say on the BBC. I'm Ben James. We bring together people around the world to discuss the issues that matter to you.
I have a condition which requires me to take medication so that I don't get either too hyper or too depressed to the point of suicide.
The British actor Stephen Fry has been talking about a suicide attempt last year. Michael Jackson's teenage daughter Paris has reportedly tried to kill herself. And earlier this week, many of you were talking about the death of Bollywood star Gia Khan. Because suicide's been one of the biggest discussions of the week, we're going to discuss it with you. How do you feel when someone you know tries to end their own life? What are the misconceptions around suicide? We're going to hear a group of people share their experiences. You're welcome to talk to them too. You can email us your contribution. We'll have your say at bbc.com.